right, I'm happy to be here. Thanks to Bill for the invitation. I'm honored to be on the same stage with Larry Ehrenhardt, who invented the semi-plausible brand of Darwinian conservatism and the leading the future of studies in technology and biotechnology in America, Sarah Beth and Brendan. So technology, biotechnology, and the permanent things. Well, technology and biotechnology are about change we can believe in. And it's change we can believe in because we came up with it. Whereas nature is cruel and random and out to kill us and altogether not a respecter of persons. Technology and biotechnology oppose themselves to the permanent things, but perhaps not always badly, because there are some things that could be changed. For example, no one's in favor of medieval dentistry. But when it comes to biotechnology, that's something new. Before, we could only use technology to change non-human nature, but now we can use technology to change our own nature. I mean, we really can. And so we have a new kind of eugenics. And the word eugenics is not necessarily bad, because it's well-born, getting better. There's some good things about it. There's two new things about eugenics today. Number one, it might really work. Until biotechnology, all human eugenics was quackery. Even the scheme in Plato's Republic is quackery. But the scheme in Superman, Man of Steel, which is modeled on the Republic to an amazing degree, is not quackery, because they actually change people genetically. They actually genetically breed, genetically come up with people who fill their roles in society. So Superman, Man of Steel, is much more plausible than Plato's Republic. But there's a bigger change when it comes to eugenics, if you think about it. Eugenics in the past was evil, and here's why. It subordinated the person to the class, or the country, to citizenship, or to the race, or even to the species. So we conservatives don't like progressive eugenics, not so much because it was quackery, but because people were subordinated to the requirements of the species. We don't were really opposed to fascist eugenics, because it subordinated the person to the requirements of the father hand or the race. And we even hate the eugenics in Plato's Republic, because it treats people as citizens and nothing more. But today, eugenics has become personal. When we talk about eugenics today, it's about extending personal existence indefinitely. When we talk about eugenics today, it's overcoming those risk factors which are out to kill me. So eugenics today is, as Larry is fond of saying, all about me. But that's good. You're going to subordinate me to the country or the class or something. I don't want to do that. But if you're going to keep me around longer, I mean, what's better than that? Because the modern theory of being personal, as you find in John Rawls and everywhere else, is when I am extinguished, being itself is extinguished. So I have to stay around, and so being has a future. So the logical culmination of modern eugenics, contemporary eugenics, is transhumanism, where I overcome the limits of my body, become somehow, in some incredible way, pure consciousness, so I can have the longevity of software or a machine. So you see eugenics, this kind of transhumanist eugenics, mocked on that very theoretical show, The Big Bang Theory, where Sheldon suddenly realized, he's the theoretical physicist on The Big Bang Theory and a principal transhumanist. He starts to think, life is risky business. I better stop leaving my room. And so he sends a screen of Sheldon to work. So the dream of the transhumanist is to become a screen, that is, to be disembodied, to be in some undisclosed location and be pure consciousness projecting itself as screen. So you think about it, technology today is all about screens. The first thing is the transeugenic project to make yourself into a screen, but because that won't really work, actually, we have screens to divert ourselves from the fact that transhumanism won't work. So I'm sure you saw the going viral YouTube-y thing by the great philosopher, comedian, Louis C.K., where he explained why he wouldn't let his daughters have cell phones, because he didn't want them to lose themselves. It's not cell phones, smartphones, really smartphones. He didn't want them to lose themselves in the screen and so forget who they are or forget what it is to be a human being who has all kinds of emotions that have nothing to do with technology at all. It can only be distorted by technology. So in thinking about technology, I learned from Yuval Levin that America is divided into two factions, and the two factions are the innovationists and the generationists. In fact, I have my class right now in technology divided into innovationists and generationists, because it goes without saying there's some truth in both directions, but you can't help but be in one camp or the other to some extent. So just like there's no such thing as a bisexual, you can think both ways are good, but you can't help but be inclined more in one direction than the other. So the innovationist privilege, disruption. The most evil word in the English language now is disruption, at least used promiscuously. So you know this Harvard professor, Christensen, came up with the disruptive theory, and he has disrupted everything there is to disrupt now. And as Elizabeth Corey explained so well, as especially pernicious as applied to education. And even though this is not part of my text, I want to explain why anyway. So if you read his first disruption book, it's about this theory. You come up with a techno innovation, you're proud of it, and so you build more expensive versions of it by adding stuff onto it. And then what happens? Someone else disrupts you by coming up with a cheap knockoff that's just good enough. So that's what these education disruptive guys are doing to us. They're going to use technology to come up with cheap knockoffs that are just good enough. End of sermon. All right, so you have, so innovationist is about disruption. The generationist is about continuity over time. So the innovationists are all about maximizing individual choice and control and pushing back nature and chance. They're all about pushing death back indefinitely, because what's the greatest barrier to choice we have? Death. It's hard to be pro-choice on one's own death. And so the innovationists aren't worried about the connections some people make between our pursuit of indefinite longevity and the birth dearth. They're open to the thought that the world to come might not need replacements, who used to be known as children, because individuals won't need to be replaced. They celebrate the techno world where it's so clear that a woman can be free enough easily to choose not to have a child. And they want to detach marriage and parenthood from biological necessity and allow them to enter the room of freedom of choice, as the Supreme Court explained in that famous mystery clause. In innovationist utopian dreams that are meant to become real, children often are not present at all. By the way, the first of these dreams is communism, as explained by Marx. So very quickly, the innovationists want all sex to be safe sex, that is, to detach from birth and death. So this is something that occurred to me 10 minutes ago, and so it's another unfortunate digression. If you think about it, Americans are divided by how they understand their birth dearth in the advanced West. They were not reaching a replacement level when it comes to kids. Category number one, the environmentalists say, good, we're still overpopulated. Nature would cheer if there were no people at all. So birth dearth, good job, keep it up. The transhumanists say more or less the same thing. as people, as technology progresses, people live longer, so naturally they don't want to have kids. Kids are getting in the way of things. Kids make you obsessive. And a lot of libertarians think the same thing. So Santorum says, a big tax break for people with kids. Libertarian objects. That's not treating them as individuals. Some other conservatives say, what causes the birth dearth? Dependency, eliminate the welfare state, kids would come back. Darwinian Larry just doesn't talk about the birth dearth at all because there's no Darwinian expert for account of it. Final one would be the truth is that the birth dearth is caused by our techno orientation towards life. The combination of the progress of medical technology and the technology of contraception. It's caused by thinking of ourselves as techno individuals most of the time, more as innovationists than generationists. So the generationist, by contrast, and Larry, to his credit, I think is in this category, as is Russell Kirk and so forth. The generationists are more about living according to nature. Their thought is conditioned by the insight that we are beings born to love and die. We can't do anything about that, and we shouldn't want to do anything about that. So the generationists are, I think Larry is right, more Darwinian, more in tune with the perpetuation of our existence as social or generative animals. They notice that the indefinite progress of technology seems to have had negative consequences for the relationships among the generations. And that's one reason the family, especially the extended family, almost seems to be withering away. The anthropology of generations, kind of a Burkean phrase, is built around what the philosopher Hannah Arendt called natality. That's a tremendous contribution to philosophy, the category of natality. Or new beginnings that come from the birth of unique and irreplaceable beings. So the generationist says our hope is most properly in children and not in gadgets or machines or information systems. In generationist futurist nightmares, people become so obsessed that children have to raise themselves. Biotechnology produces designer babies that are or is treated as manufactured commodities. So the innovationists are all about producing the means to produce happiness. The generationists are all about the happiness that comes by following our desires, doing our duties as social animals in the context of social institutions, and finding our significance as part of social wholes greater than ourselves. Now, there's a lot more to say about this, except to say the innovationists aren't simply right, and the generationists aren't simply right. The generationists sometimes are too often stuck in romantic future fantasies about the past. They forget, and by the way, Russell Kirk never forgot this, they forgot that all sensible nostalgia is selective, which is why you can think south without thinking slavery. That all sensible nostalgia is selective, and that there are many features about our techno world that no one in his right mind would want to give up, even for the necessity-driven virtue of the past. Thanks to technological progress, almost all children born these days in our free country get to become adults. You realize how recent that is, that all children get to become adults? And so death in childhood is an astonishing accident. On the frontier, they had 13 and 8 men adulthood, and it's a good job. Today, we have the high-risk Darwinian strategy of having one and hope my genes make it, but it's plausible nowadays to have one. Before, you had to have at least 5 to have any chance of your genes making it to the next generation. The truth of the matter is, technology, like birth, love, and death, is a wonderful display of part of who we are, of what we can do for ourselves. And there's a lot of truth in the personal orientation of contemporary technology, because the truth is we really are persons and not simply parts of some wholes. So the truth is that our lives are marked by both freedom and necessity, and an innovative generationist or a generational innovator would be animated by a view of personal and relational freedom that would do justice to Darwinian theory and do justice to the personal theory that drives our technology. And so let me just say something about sounds like a situation comedy. Something about Larry. Partly because Bill said I would. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say something about what Larry said about me. Of course, many people deny this Darwinian explanation of human behavior. Existentialist conservatives like Peter Lawler. When Larry started this stuff, he had existentialist, Gnostic, Heideggerian conservative. That was kind of unfortunate branding, Heidegger being a Nazi and all. But when Larry says existentialist, and if you think about it, in the category is included Christian. In the category is anyone who believes personal being is not completely contained in biology. Here's what Peter Lawler says, existentialist, not Peter Lawler, but all the existentialist conservatives like Peter Lawler. I think this was a good summary. Darwinism is only partly true. Why? Because although it explains our animal sociality, we really are social animals, right? It cannot explain our deepest existential longings for love and meaning in our lives and our fear of death. I would correct that by our longing to be more than biological beings. It's not just fear of death, really. We cannot live with the Darwinian teaching that we are just very smart. That means existentialist conservatives like me can't man up. And live with the Darwinian teaching that we are just very smart social mammals who live for a time and die in a universe that does not care for or about us. We, existentialist conservatives, are moved by transcendent longings for a universe in which we are the center of attention. And the next part is in italics. Here's what we think. It is all about me. Me, me, me. But let me just respond a bit. When I say Darwin is half right, I mean we really are you social animals. But we're more than that. We're personal and relational beings. We retain our personal identities while in love with each other. And polymorphous human eros is much more than the desire given to the other mammals to max out on reproductive fitness. The self-conscious, relational, and truthful character of our longings transforms in some measure all our erotic activities. Birds do it, bees do it, dolphins do it, chimps do it, and we do it. But our doing it carries a lot more baggage. So I'm no existentialist. It's the transhumanist who say it's all about me, who won't rest content with being born to love and die. So I join Larry in mocking their hopes, as well as wondering about what their efforts will do to the relational lives, which really are the source of most human happiness. So Larry can explain what's wrong with transhumanism, and even in some ways what's wrong with existentialism, but he can't explain why there are transhumanists or why there are existentialists. He can't even explain Woody Allen, who said very memorably, "I don't want to be immortal through my work, I want to be immortal through not dying." So here's what I really think. Larry seems way existential to me. And so he has to live with the knowledge that his love for his wife is merely animal sociality. And only a real man can do that, I have to admit, but it can't explain why his wife might wish for more. Larry can't deny as a matter of cold, hard, empirical fact that members of our species alone have always been moved by transcendent longings. All he can do is say those longings are unreasonable because they can't possibly be satisfied. So, for example, Larry has this, to me, fairly random list of natural desires, and one of them is on there is for a complete life. Now, when my students read Larry's chapter that said this, they jumped on that. They said, you know, we long for more than a complete life. A Darwinian longing for a complete life would be something like this. All right, I pair bond spread my genes, raise my young, and say, whew, I'm done, I'm complete, I am checking out now. But in fact, we don't do that. In fact, we live in this creepy world where women are getting a whole generation beyond menopause. And I look around this room at some of you women and I say, why the blank are you still here? I mean, but the reason you're still here is you think, geez, I don't think my life is complete yet. My kids are 58, 62, and 67, but I still don't think my life is complete. And so, in fact, it's just not true that we long only for a complete life. Right? It's just not right. I mean, not one of my students bought that. So in my opinion, Darwinian conservatism is a kind of self-help program. If you read Larry, you will somehow be cured of your so-called transcendent longings. But the other mammals don't need such a scientific or philosophic remedy. Maybe Larry does really think that Darwin can cure us all, and his teaching is the program we really need. And that's why, as I said before, Larry is an evangelical Darwinian. He's spreading the good news that will cure us of our homelessness. And so Larry criticizes members of our species, such as me, let me repeat, for being unable to live with the Darwinian teaching. What's wrong with me that I can't live with that? But the thing is, that sounds pretty Nietzschean to me, like really existential. Man up, be courageous, face the abyss. It's not really an abyss. If you're a real man, you can be a Darwinian. A real man has to have the courage to live with the terrible truth of Darwin. And my question is, what dolphin has to do that? What other animal has to live in the truth? What other animal can find the truth either joyful or terrible? Other animals may instinctively fear death. Lots of new evidence on the elephants in the New Atlantis. But what other animal looks for and comes up with techno remedies in response? Looks for and comes up with techno remedies in response to that fear. What other animal can feel anxiety in the face of nothing, as does Louis C.K.? And the truth is that anxiety that seems to be the prelude to genuine wonder about who we are and what we're supposed to do. So Darwinian science, as partly true as it is, shouldn't really be confused with philosophy. If you say it explains everything, then you've confused science with scientism. Thank you.